The need is not really for more brains. The need is for a gentler, more tolerant people than those who won for us against the axe, the tiger, and the bear. The hand that hefted the axe, out of some old blind allegiance to the past, now fondles the machine gun, or nuclear button, as lovingly. It is a habit people will have to break to survive, but the roots go very deep. From Lauren Isley. But the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Against such there is no law. Galatians 6. These two quotations, one from a 20th century American scientist and one from a first century Jewish Christian, both address moral character. They exhort us to be certain kinds of persons so that we might do some things differently. Isley thinks the stakes are survival, but that the aggressive cultural habits are very deep and hard to break. Paul's is a word of hope, confident that human transformation is possible, indeed is a reality, in a new community of the Spirit. To focus on moral character may seem several steps removed from the pressing issues of rural development. After all, the obvious needs there are so clearly material ones: food, health, shelter, employment. And the skills necessary are largely technical ones: improved agricultural production, more effective disease prevention and control, building and administrative skills. Moral character seems secondary at best. Yet Langdon Gilkey's reflections are instructive. In 1943, Gilkey and 1,500 other foreigners were taken by the Japanese occupation forces and placed in an internment camp in North China, Shantung Compound. The Japanese controlled the borders of the compound tightly and permitted no one to leave. But they turned virtually all of the internal camp matters over to the inmates. Thus the inmates, a diverse collection of people with varied skills, had as strangers to one another the task of forging civilization on a microscopic scale. And what was learned occasioned Gilkey's book. As he explains, this internment camp reduced society, ordinarily large and complex, to viewable size, and by subjecting life to greatly increased tension, laid bare its essential structures. Because internment camp life seems to reveal more clearly than does ordinary experience the anatomy of social and moral problems and the bases of human communal existence, this book has been written. With him into Shantung Compound, Gilkey brought a certain cultural and philosophical perspective, one which he called the confident humanism, so characteristic of liberal academic cultures and circles in America. His initial experience in this unique development project ratified that confident humanism. The most valuable contributions were clearly those of practical skills and technical genius and administrative cunning. People with basic know-how and people who were creative problem solvers were the indispensable ones. Indeed, Gilkey himself, as a philosopher and theologian, severely doubted the value of those enterprises. He concluded that, in fact, religious and philosophical reflection and moral and ethical inquiry were all interesting for a few, but were simply not essential to society. Society could fare amazingly well with the spirit of pragmatism and a touch of technical genius. And so he wrote in his journal, humanity's ingenuity in dealing with difficult problems was unlimited, making irrelevant those so-called deeper issues of spiritual life with which religion and philosophy pretended to deal. Gilkey then was given an important practical task. He was placed in charge of housing. And from that immersion in the details of development work emerged a different discovery. And here I have to quote him at some length. Gradually, however, as I encountered more and more unexpected problems in my work in housing, I began to realize that my confident attitude towards things simply did not fit the realities of camp life. It was not that our material crises seemed any less urgent, or that our minds were less capable of dealing with them. Rather, new sorts of problems kept arising that improved know-how could not resolve. For over and over, what we can only call moral or spiritual difficulties continually cropped up. Crises occurred that involved not a breakdown in techniques, but a breakdown in character, showing the need for more moral integrity and self-sacrifice. The trouble with my new humanism, I found myself deciding, was not its confidence in human science and technology. It was rather its naive and unrealistic faith in the rationality and goodness of those who wielded these instruments. If courage and integrity were evidenced in every facet of camp life, equally apparent was the intense difficulty all of us experienced in being fair-minded, not to say just or generous, under the hard pressure of our rough and trying existence. Most important of all, what became increasingly plain was that these crises of the soul were not of such a character as to disturb merely the prim and the straight-laced in our midst. On a critical level, equal to an outbreak of dysentery or a stoppage of our bread supply, these moral breakdowns were so serious that they threatened the very existence of our community. It became increasingly evident to me that unless these inward crises could be resolved, the entire microscopic civilization, which we had so painstakingly established to feed and care for us, would not live much longer. I began to see that without moral health, a community is as helpless and lost as it is without material supplies and services. This was the deepest lesson I learned from this experience. Since that time, both in studies and in observation generally, it has seemed to me to be a truth validated over and over in the life of every human society, great or small. Let me state Gilkey's point differently. While society certainly does require goods and services and the skills and the resources to muster and distribute them, society also floats on a sea of morality. And the condition of the society depends as heavily on the condition of its supporting morality as it does upon its material resources. Now, this is a paper in development ethics. Development is pervasive and planned change in a society from one condition to another condition that the society deems more desirable. Such development normally entails what are in fact three different kinds of change. Technological change is the most obvious, different and hopefully better ways of doing things. There is also change in the systems and the structures of society and development work, change in the arrangements that put and hold things together. And there is frequently what can be designated change in the inner world of society and culture, change in the images, the values, the outlooks, the identity that give people's lives direction and meaning. Most development work attends to technological change and its institutional and systemic setting. Thus, most development work focuses on practical skills and the machinery and the education needs for their productive employment. Usually, there is also an acknowledgement of the importance of so-called softer realities, people's values and identity, or moral and religious and aesthetic traditions, or other dimensions of the inner life of culture. But there is disproportionately little sustained attention to those. This third arena of change is the one this paper worries over. I want to accomplish two goals: to show the vital place of moral character for development patterns for society, and to assess my own culture's inner life and show the consequences for development. I can't describe and assess all dimensions of my culture's moral character, so I've selected the dominant image or images that have shaped our collective understanding and behavior. That's a global undertaking itself. Nonetheless, Even in pluralist societies, people widely share ways of viewing themselves in their world. And though it's imprecise, it's nonetheless meaningful to talk about a Chinese way of seeing things, or an Indian perspective, or Western culture, or the Renaissance view of humanity and nature, or the outlook of medieval Catholicism, or the way of life in the colonial era. Each of those, however complex, includes reigning images that express and shape the morality of the civilization or of the era. Collective self-understanding and shared moral character are formed and informed by prevailing cultural images. In the Confessions, Augustine writes in awe of the human mind. Note his metaphors as he speaks in astonishment of, quote, the mountains and hills of my high imaginations, the plains and caverns of my memory, with its manifold and spacious chambers, wonderfully furnished with innumerable stores. Whence those images? They bear a marked resemblance to the geography of North Africa, specifically the caverned hills of Carthage, his home. In describing the interior terrain of his mind, Augustine reflects, consciously or not, the world around him. That should not surprise us. But I make the point because worldview and morality in my culture also reflects its world, including its geography. And not only as a handy reservoir for metaphors, but as a reservoir of moral content itself. In 1906, the German scholar Werner Sombart published a volume. It was entitled, Why Is There No Socialism in America? I will interject some reasons that he didn't include, but should have, in a telescoped version of his reply. The newcomers to North American shores, Sombart noted, turn of the century, stepped onto a vast continent of temperate climate, incredibly rich in food, fiber, wood, soil, and minerals. There was wealth both below and above the ground. Furthermore, this Eden from sea to shining sea was sparsely populated, and there was no entrenched feudal order to overthrow, nor any other set of established economic, political, and social systems to dissemble or dismantle. Native Americans, called Indians, because Columbus's address book didn't tell him he had missed by one continent and one ocean, Native Americans could occasionally pose problems, but the settlers were sufficiently convinced of the requirements of civilization to know what to do with such troublemakers. Two, for the first century and a half, the British Navy and the Union Jack paid the defense bill. For the second century, the two-ocean moat worked rather well. And even the two great wars of the third century were fought from a sanctuary that was not touched. Indeed, for us, the Second World War saw the first years of an extraordinary economic boom that continued in the decades which followed, generating historically unprecedented affluence. But I've leaped beyond Sombart's 1906 report, and we have to slide back down the timeline a moment. The new arrivals came to North America in wave upon wave. From Europe, it was the restless, the ambitious, sometimes the devout, and to an impressive degree, the skilled. Many of them possessed an extraordinary drive, the Protestant ethic supplemented with the normal portion of human ambition and laced with a little greed. This aggressive spirit on the part of many is captured in a 19th century European diary. Quote, I'd rather face 1,000 attacking Turks than one Calvinist bent on doing the will of God. North America was settled by thousands of such Calvinists. More importantly, the drive and spirit remained even as the Protestant ethic was transformed into a secular Yankee work and riches ethic. It's probably not ever been better expressed than in Chicago by the American poet laureate Carl Sandburg. Hog butcher for the world, tool maker, stacker of wheat, player with railroads and the nation's freight handler, stormy, husky, brawling city of the big shoulders. They tell me you are wicked, and I believe them, for I have seen your painted women under the gas lamps, luring the farm boys. And they tell me you are crooked, and I answer, yes, it is true, I have seen the gunman kill and go free to kill again. And they tell me you are brutal, and my reply is, on the faces of women and children I have seen the marks of wanton hunger. And having answered, so I turn once more to those who sneer at this my city, and I give them back the sneer and say to them, come and show me another city with lifted head, singing so proud to be alive and coarse and strong and cunning, flinging magnetic curses amid the toil of piling job on job. Here is a tall, bold slugger set vivid against the little, soft cities. Fierce as a dog with tongue lapping for action, cunning as a savage pitted against the wilderness, bareheaded, shoveling, wrecking, planning, building, breaking, rebuilding, under the smoke, dust all over his mouth, laughing with white teeth, under the terrible burden of destiny, laughing as a young man laughs, laughing even as an ignorant fighter laughs who has never lost a battle, bragging and laughing that under his wrist is the pulse and under his ribs the heart of the people, laughing, laughing the stormy, husky, brawling laughter of youth, half naked, sweating, proud to be hog butcher, tool maker, stacker of wheat, player with railroads and freight handler to the nation. Sandburg best reflects the industrial culture of the latter part of the 19th century and the first decades of this one. Yet if you think this poem dated, you haven't heard the official proclaimed morality of the Reagan administration and its supporters. I am thinking of its Bible, George Gilder's book, Wealth and Poverty, but I'm going to read a mobile ad entitled, mobile oil ad entitled, Watch Out, World. There has been no social phenomenon in years to compare with the current national commitment to revitalize the U.S. spirit and economy. We welcome this new American consciousness, this new dedication to renaissance, and the winds of change it is generating. If we sounded occasionally peevish about the national apathy in times past, it was in reflection of our confidence that the dynamic and creative energies of the American people, once aroused and unleashed, would once again surpass the impressive social and economic achievements that glimmer all through our history. It looks today as though Uncle Sam is at last stripping down for some hard, productive work. Watch out, world. You ain't seen nothing yet. End of ad. This is the unceasing activity of the imperial self, the fast pace making and remaking of the world. It is Chicago. And when I, as a true child of this culture, slow down myself, I sometimes consider T.S. Eliot's reply. This is dedicated to Janet in thanks for the Vespers this evening, from T.S. Eliot's Choruses from a Rock. The endless cycle of ideas and actions, endless invention, endless experiment, brings knowledge of motion, but not of stillness. Knowledge of speech, but not of silence. Knowledge of words, but ignorance of the word. Capital W. But let me slide back down the timeline again and return to the immigrants, this time forced. From Africa, an enormous workforce spilled from the lower decks of the slavers, women, men, and children who for two centuries provided labor at what were literally slave wages. And this massive venture in development took place over a relatively long period, as development projects in modern times go, as a nation moved from an agrarian, labor-intensive society to an urban, energy- and capital-intensive one. In this development drama, there was more than the North American continent's gifts of nature. There were also gifts of history, One of those was a free late start on the Industrial Revolution. In our youth, we were a developing nation that benefited from the flow of knowledge, technology, and skills that came from elsewhere, chiefly England. We joined the Industrial Revolution after some others paid the inevitable development costs. To be sure, the relationship between us and our colonizers was one we regarded as rawly exploitative, and we complained bitterly about the terms of trade, which favored the wealthier, more powerful nations. Finally, we tired and we just sent the British packing, with some help from the French, some hired German mercenaries, and the fact that the British were preoccupied elsewhere. But we did benefit from the European advances in science and technology, and soon we became an industrial and technological power in our own right. Now, in all of this, you see the conditions for extraordinary socio-economic mobility. And you can understand why Sombart saw in these gifts of nature and history the reasons why so many immigrants from Europe shed whatever Marxism they might have had in their bags. For us, it has been move and grow, grow and move, in an extraordinarily rich setting, during something that in retrospect begins to look like a 200-year boom. The costs have indeed been high. We are still paying the bill for racism, the rapacious treatment of the good earth, and the current problems of a deeply troubled international economic order. But whatever the costs, this is the outer world that has so deeply shaped the moral character of millions of North Americans and the development patterns that we have both experienced and recommended. There is in us a deeply ingrained sense of the unlimited, an expansive thrust, an entrepreneurial and an engineering mentality, a press for the bold transformation of both nature and society, all characteristics that Karl Marx not only recognized as the capitalist ethos, but stood in awe of himself. As an aside, two portraits hung in the factories in Russia under Vladimir Ilyich Lenin in many of the factories. One was Karl Marx, the other portrait was Henry Ford. Yet if I trace this spirit to my continent only, or identify the ethos as capitalist only, my tale is only half told. The roots are deeper and the influences are wider. I must add the heritage of the Enlightenment to that of the Industrial Revolution. Consider this little episode. Nyla and I joined friends on a climb of Mount Kilimanjaro. At the end of the 5-day trek, I was greeted by an American acquaintance who exclaimed, "Hey, you really did it! You conquered Kilimanjaro!" It was a remark natural to an American. A native Tanzanian wouldn't have conceived that journey as a conquest. The American thought no further of the metaphor and went on to ask the details of conquering Kilimanjaro. Whence did the remark arise? In the marriage of the Enlightenment and the Industrial Revolution. What the Enlightenment brought is a particular way of seeing. An autonomous human self is set over against the world. That self is an independent, creative, detached, rational agent. The world is essentially loose hardware. It's stuff available for our creativity. There are human beings. The rest constitutes resources. This is essentially an imperial self in a world that is essentially plastic. But this understanding of self and world is only one party to the marriage. The other is the dramatic break between pre-industrial and industrial society. I must explain. Jeremy Rifkin, usually so insightfully wrong, is right when he says, quote, "Every civilization lives off a resource base which provides the context for the types of institutions, technologies, and worldviews that are developed," end of quotation. This resource base is that of non-renewable energy sources. Industrial society, whether capitalist or socialist, is built upon these, and our worldview rests here as well. What is that worldview? The non-renewables, first coal, then oil and natural gas, then uranium, now all of them together, permitted a massive departure from agrarian societies, a departure we call industrial civilization. Its distinction is its stored sun energy base. The non-renewable energy sources are, in effect, stored sun. Pre-industrial society had to wait around for nature to yield its gifts in its own due seasons. The non-renewables have permitted us to bypass nature's cycles and seasons frequently and, so to speak, turn the sun on and off at will. Such was only dimly known to pre-industrial society. It is our very existence, even in agricultural America. With this energy base, we created what the French so neatly refer to as a nature artificielle, an inorganic environment. That has gone to our heads. It has transformed our minds. It is our mind's geography, much as North American caves and caverns and oases were Augustine's. Let me just insert here. My brother-in-law is a farmer rancher. When he farms the land he uses, among the other large machines, he uses a $25,000 tractor. He, one individual, plows several hundred acres with it. It's an elaborate machine powered by fossil fuels. He climbs off the land and into an enclosed cab. If it's hot, he turns on the air conditioner. If it's cold, he turns on the heater. Then he puts Billy Joel into the tape deck. Then he traverses the field, and if he's not done by the time the sun goes down, he turns on the lights and he works, if he wishes, the night through. If I'd say to him, "What did you do today?" he probably wouldn't say, "I turned the black soil under my toes." He'd probably say, "I rode the tractor all day and half the night, and I got the field done." Bonhoeffer once cryptically observed about a certain Western historical process, quote, "the aim to be independent of nature. Nature was formerly conquered," note the word, "by spiritual means, with us by technical organization of all kinds. Our immediate environment is not nature, but organization." This technical conquest of nature has been astonishingly successful. And it's the dramatic difference between industrial and pre-industrial society. Yet the salient point is about our worldview. Industrial society has let us believe we could have a world of our own design and making. That is the heady stuff of all Western patterns of development, domestic or imported. We have married the Enlightenment sense of an imperial self over against a world subject to unlimited transformation and, or with, the quantum leap in human powers for such transformation which the Industrial Revolution bequeathed. Let me say this differently. The master Western image since the Enlightenment and Industrial Revolution has been the image of mastery itself. How internalized and extended is this cultural image? It is commonplace now to speak of spaceship Earth. Why has that symbol caught on, since there are no accidental cultural symbols? Because we learned some things in conquering Kilimanjaro. We learned that we had to be wrested away from the view that the world is possessed of unlimited resources. And we learned what is now conventional ecological wisdom. Everything is connected to everything else. You can never do merely one thing. There's no such thing as a free lunch. Spaceship Earth is now our cultural symbol for saying that we've learned that we live in a fragile, complex world of interdependent, cyclical systems. In stark contrast to the brutal aggressiveness of Chicago, Spaceship Earth tells us the world is finite, and requires of us gentle care and conservation. But take another look at the symbol. Spaceship Earth is a perfect fit for the image of mastery. It is a world of our own design and making. The spaceship is the human construct par excellence, a supreme natur artificiel, and a grand example of energy-intensive, capital-intensive, fine-tuned technological wizardry. If the gods enjoy ironies, they must be in stitches. The best symbol we can muster to exhibit the humble creatureliness of planet Earth and our delicate place in it is the very symbol by which we also assert our supposed sovereign break from the hold of nature, even gravity, and proudly demonstrate that we do indeed, after all, have a world of our own creation. What is a spaceship to do? Help us conquer space, of course. Conquer space? Conquer space? Is that like harnessing the sun when we develop solar energy systems? Or being co-creators with God when we write theology? Or standing in as Miss Universe when we are gorgeous and winsome? Evidently, it is like conquering Kilimanjaro. But the morality of mastery pertains not only to nature. Since at least Marx and Smith, Adam Smith, it includes society, and since at least Freud, it extends to the psyche. The latter is reflected in a student union advertisement near my place of work. It reads, "Interpersonal skill building groups. In these 10-session skill-focused groups, students will be taught to monitor and master anxiety using improved social skills by learning to be appropriately assertive." The offer goes on to speak of designing experiences and acquiring skills to establish trust. All of this is done in a workshop led by someone trained for the job. You take your psyche to the workshop and work on it. This is the world of those who reach for control of their lives. It is, in fact, an engineering view of the world. Not only the world, now only the world to be designed, monitored, and mastered is the world of the psyche and of intimate relationships. Not only can mountains be conquered, but so too can the terrain of the self and the terrain between selves. Lest the description of cultural understanding of self and world stray too far from development issues, let me focus for a minute on the economic dream of Western culture. The economic dream of the Enlightenment and the Industrial Revolution has been the dream of a better world attained through increasing productivity and adequate distribution, both of which would be fairly easy to realize. That dream has had two different versions, but because the versions have competed savagely with one another, the fact that they are the same dream has been obscured. The first version was formulated by Adam Smith. It rested on two discoveries, the division of labor, which multiplied productivity, and the workings of the market. Smith hoped this arrangement of skills and processes would bring what he called universal opulence that would be shared by even the lowest ranks of people, end of quotation. The second version was Karl Marx's. It assumed capitalism's enormous capacity for solving the problem of production and went on from there to plot the reforms necessary to arrange productivity in such a way as to happen without oppression and in such a manner that provided, as Marx said, taking a cue from the Book of Acts, to each according to need. Both versions of the dream have shared what is for the human story a breathtaking conviction. Namely, that society can be arranged in such a way that both affluence and freedom are possible for all. Who said, quote, the free development of each is the condition for the free development of all, end of quotation. It was Karl Marx, but it might as easily have been said by Adam Smith or Milton Friedman or Ronald Reagan or Friedrich Engels. All have believed in the socially redeeming character of increased wealth, albeit within very different socioeconomic arrangements. The Gilkey, Smith, and Marx philosophy of confident humanism has now fallen on hard times. I only point to the disappointment that has met the United Nations' two development decades and the planetary state of affairs outlined in a single paragraph by one from your own ranks, the Indians, Metropolitan Paulos Gregorius, in the book The Human Presence, An Orthodox View of Nature. Gregorius cites what he calls three major problems. One, the appalling poverty of billions of people, perpetuated by atrocious economic injustice and exploitation. Two, satiety, boredom, and a sense of meaninglessness among the affluent, raising fundamental questions about the values of the consumer society and the urban industrial society built upon it. Three, fundamental challenges to the human future posed by the cumulative perils of a scientific technological culture, such as resource depletion, pollution, and the possibilities of misuse of artificial gene mutation, not to mention nuclear war. This report of the dismal and the dangerous not only doubts the liberal dream of industrial civilization, but between the lines, it indicts the morality of those who aspire to live by mastery and control in a creation regarded as resources. But our life is not one of the imperial self and the world as abstraction. It is the concrete world of particular persons and groups, of particular classes, races, sexes, dominant in subcultures, with particular technologies and other powers, in particular systems with particular arrangements. And that brings me, in closing, to the critique that has arisen in North American theological circles. It is shared outside North America, but I concentrate on the indigenous sources. Let me post the conclusion first. What I have described as the cultural marriage of the Enlightenment and the Industrial Revolution is not, these critics say, simply the way things are and ought to be. It is a particular social morality that is more male than female, more white than black or brown or red, more rich than poor, more north than south, and with a view of humanity a more apart from rather than a part of the rest of creation. The details are these. Environmentalist theology exposes the human arrogance in the morality of mastery, that we've regarded ourselves above and apart from rather than within and a part of life's web. Native American theology has said that with unsurpassed eloquence, and has gone on to document the negative consequences of the morality of mastery, not only for the good earth, but the negative consequences for all peoples whose culture has viewed the natural environment as literally a sacred trust filled with the spirit. Black theology exposes the hierarchical patterns along race and caste lines. It also joins theology done from the underside, from the side of the poor, in pointing to neocolonialist socioeconomic patterns. Feminist theology has not only surfaced in minute detail a hierarchical grid laid atop reality, but exposed its patriarchal character. God as Father and King and Lord is a way of making the attributes of fathers and kings and lords the culturally determinative ones and ones women do not share. Two, it is male rationality that sees the world in mechanistic terms and in terms of conquest. Soviet SS-20 missiles and US MX missiles are expressions of male reality. In their criticism of a social morality that is hierarchical and patriarchal, these voices focus on the reality of power relationships. And in all three areas earlier named, nature, society, and psyche, sin, they contend, is twofold. For the powerless, sin is acquiescence to maldistributed and oppressive power and its mystifications. For the powerful, sin is the cornering and maintenance of control. Reconciliation is breaking down the barriers between sexes, classes, races, and the barriers between human and non-human creation. And it happens, in their view, by more egalitarian power arrangements. The presence of God is in the presence of justice. And perhaps most fundamentally of all, the reality of creation is that it is irreducibly relational in character. I will close. I am reporting that the liberal dream of the Enlightenment and Industrial Revolution, of mastery and affluence, has been challenged from within the ranks of its own successful establishment, to say nothing from the periphery and from those who have benefited least from it and suffered most. I am also trying to report the culture that has more than anything else expressed and defined modern modes of development. But my primary reason for this insider's critique of North American development is to show the crucial place, for better or worse, of moral character in society and in any development enterprise. With Gilkey, I want to say that without moral health, a community is as helpless and lost as it is without material supplies and services. Or differently said, what a particular society can become is not more than its supporting morality allows. Significant change in development, then, is not only technological and systemic, it is that of the inner life of society and culture. I am certain I have signaled my own hopes for my own culture's moral health with the opening quotations, now the closing ones. The need is not really for more brains. The need is for a gentler, more tolerant people than those who won for us against the ice, the tiger, and the bear. The hand that hefted the axe out of some old blind allegiance to the past now fondles the machine gun or nuclear button as lovingly. It is a habit people will have to break to survive, but the roots go very deep. But the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Against such there is no law. Thank you.